It's the NPR News Update for Friday, August 29. I'm Phil Picardi with Minnesota News on your schedule. Coming up on the podcast, there were two police shootings yesterday in the Twin Cities. A group wants to bring a World's Fair to Minnesota, and what to do with old, dilapidated barns. Law enforcement officials are investigating two separate fatal officer-involved shootings that happened over a span of 9 hours yesterday in the Twin Cities. Around 7 a.m. on the west side of St. Paul, officers shot and killed a man who they say had been smashing vehicle windows with a pipe and then attacked police at the scene. Then, yesterday afternoon in Anoka County, police killed a man who pulled a gun on them. Peter Cox reports on that shooting.
Yesterday afternoon, three men in a vehicle pulled into the parking lot of the Learning Lodge Daycare Center in Ramsey. Commander Paul Summer of the Anoka County Sheriff's Office says a call came in from the daycare around 3 p.m.
It was suspicious to the daycare staff. It was three males in a car. Apparently, there weren't anybody the staff was familiar with, and they were just sitting in the car. You know, so it's, you know, your classic police call, an occupied suspicious vehicle.
Two officers responded in separate squad cars. They approached the vehicle, Summer said.
One of the three got out of the car and began to run. When the officers gave chase, the suspect pointed a handgun at them, and the Ramsey officers then opened fire, striking the suspect. The suspect was initially transported to Mercy Hospital, where he was pronounced dead.
Summer says no children were harmed in the shooting. He says initial reports are that the man had opened fire on officers, but said that is yet to be nailed down, with the investigation only in its first stages. He did not know if one or both officers opened fire on the man. He said the suspect ran less than 20 yards before turning around on the officers. The man has not been identified, and Summer did not know whether he had a criminal history. The two other men stayed in the vehicle during the incident and were taken in for questioning immediately after the shooting. Summer said it is unclear why the three men were in the area, but the daycare center went on lockdown.
For about 30 minutes while the initial investigation took place, but once the suspects were secured and that we had a secure perimeter, we evacuated the staff and children of the daycare center.
The staff and children went across the street to a church. Staff members were still in the building last evening, but declined to speak to reporters. The officers are on standard paid administrative leave. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is investigating the officer-involved shooting in Ramsey. St. Paul police have not yet released the identity of the man shot yesterday morning or the officers involved. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Ramsey.
St. Paul police officials say a video of a man being arrested earlier this year does not tell the whole story behind that incident. Brant Williams reports.
The video, posted recently on YouTube, has gone viral. The cell phone footage shows a St. Paul police officer asking a man in a Skyway for his name. The man refuses, saying he hasn't broken any laws. Another officer tells the man he's going to jail. The man then accuses the officers of singling him out because he's black. The picture goes dark when the cell phone falls to the floor. The audio captures sounds of the man shouting for help and the buzzing of a taser. A St. Paul police report identified the man as 28-year-old Christopher Lally. In a statement posted on the department's Facebook page, police say Lally, quote, resisted officers' lawful orders. Lally was arrested and booked for disorderly conduct and obstructing the legal process. Police officials say those charges were dropped and that Lally has not filed a formal complaint. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Even as federal authorities try to stop the flow of potential fighters from Minnesota to Syria, more are on the way. That's according to the FBI's head agent in Minneapolis, who tells NPR News people are leaving the state to join terrorist groups in Syria as we speak. Laura Ewan has been following the developing story, and she talked with Stephen John last night.
What did the FBI officials say about the most recent departures?
Special Agent in Charge Rick Thornton didn't offer a lot of specifics, you know, in terms of how many fighters left or exactly when they left. But he did say they traveled from Minnesota to Syria very recently. And this confirms some of the things we've heard unofficially from people in the local Somali-American community. But even with the most recent wave of trips, the FBI is still characterizing the total number of Minnesotans who are fighting in Syria as just a handful. And when you look at the total number of Americans overall who have joined the fighting there, that number is believed to be more than 100.
The FBI has poured a lot of resources into the threat of American fighters aligning with terrorist groups. How could more people be slipping away unnoticed at a time when so much attention is focused on this issue?
Well, Thornton told us today that identifying these recruits is like finding a needle in a haystack. Over the past several years, the FBI has reached out particularly to the Somali American community, and they've asked them to be on the lookout for anyone who might be considered disaffected, who might have a void in their lives that they're looking to fill, and who have taken up a radical form of Islam. And that's because there has been a history of mostly Somali American men who traveled to Somalia to fight for the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Mm-hmm. But the news this week that Douglas MacArthur McCain, who grew up here in the Twin Cities, mm-hmm. has died fighting for ISIS in Syria, is a really good reminder that the problem isn't isolated to the Somali community because McCain was not Somali.
What do we know, Laura, about reports that a second American fighter may have died while fighting for ISIS?
Those details are very, very sketchy now, but you're right. There are a lot of reports out there, including media outlets as well as social media, that have reported on his death. He's actually a man my colleague, Mukhtar Ibrahim, profiled back in June. And this man, he claimed to have left the Twin Cities to fight alongside ISIS. His name is Abdurrahman Mohammed. But the stories out there so far have, frankly, some very flimsy sourcing.
What do you mean, flimsy sourcing?
Just entire stories based on unnamed sources. Mm-hmm. We did obtain a very graphic photograph that is being circulated in the community that some people claim is Muhammad. We were told by a third party that this photo was texted to the family after he was killed. It shows him lying on the ground after apparently being shot in the head. Mm. He's wearing a dark military vest. He has a beard. But it's really difficult for us to confirm whether this is the same man we reported on a few months ago. We've reached out to several family members and haven't been able to get anyone to talk to us.
What do official sources say about that death?
The State Department said today the same thing they told reporters yesterday, which is they can't confirm his death. But on social media, that's another story. The State Department has its own unit that aims to counter terrorist groups. On that unit's Twitter feed, it posted a local TV news story that reported Muhammad had been killed. And that tweet said Muhammad, quote, wastes his life dying for ISIS. So there appears to be a different standard and different messages that the State Department is signaling from the podium and on social media.
Laura, why are federal authorities so alarmed by the trend of Americans going off to fight in foreign lands?
Western recruits are very valuable to groups like ISIS because they might be able to travel given that they have U.S. passports. So Rick Thornton, the FBI chief in Minneapolis, he says it's a small group, but it's a very dangerous threat when you think of their mobility.
And the real concern is that people that they go over there, they fight, and at some point in time they return home further radicalized and with the training and the skills and potentially the motivation to do harm back in the United States.
And in fact, the national director of the FBI, James Comey, told us a few months ago that this is the issue that he wakes up every morning about worrying.
Laura Ewan and Stephen John on All Things Considered. Minnesota regulators have approved an oil pipeline project for northern Minnesota. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
The decision allows Enbridge to increase the Alberta Clipper Pipeline's capacity to 800,000 barrels per day. The project includes building four new pump stations, but does not involve laying new pipeline. Environmental groups had urged the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to deny Enbridge a certificate of need, saying the increased capacity isn't needed to meet energy demands. Opponents also argued the crude oil the pipeline carries from Canada's oil sands contributes to climate change. The commission heard several hours of debate, but eventually approved the expansion project, and Enbridge says it will begin construction this fall. The project still needs federal environmental review and State Department approval because it crosses a U.S. border. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota Congressman Tim Walz hosted a workshop to help first responders and emergency planners learn about funding opportunities for rail safety training. Elizabeth Baer has more.
Walz held the workshop in Rochester as an extension to a series of listening sessions earlier this year with local, state, and federal officials.
This is more about aligning resources. How do these communities that are strapped, that don't have a lot of extra, how do they get resources to send their first responders to training? And some of it's going to be paid for by Canadian Pacific. We're trying to figure out if there's some other resources.
Meanwhile, BNSF Railway announced it has trained 1,200 Minnesota first responders in community hazmat training sessions this year. The company plans to send another 130 Minnesota firefighters to specialized training on transporting oil. Last year, U.S. railroads hauled about 415,000 carloads of crude oil, compared to fewer than 10,000 cars in 2008. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
Minnesota Senator Al Franken says he regrets having held two traffic cones up to his chest while campaigning in Arizona a couple of years ago. But Republicans are still trying to make an issue of that stunt. Here's Mark Zedeklik.
Until Thursday, Franken had refused to comment on a short video clip Republicans have been circulating that shows him playing with the two traffic cones. Franken says it was a moment when he wasn't thinking.
I just think it was a thoughtless moment. Obviously, someone was shooting me from that I wasn't aware of, and, you know, it was just a moment I regret.
Republican Mike McFadden, who's challenging Franken this year, called the senator's statement far from an apology.
He said he didn't know he was being videotaped. I mean, as a parent, I'd send my kid back to his room.
When asked whether the campaign should be focused more on policy, McFadden slammed Franken for agreeing to take part in only three debates. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News at the State Fair.
There's been a big drop in the number of residential building permits issued in the Twin Cities. Matt Sepik reports.
The Builders Association of the Twin Cities says home builders received permits for just 532 new single-family homes this month. That includes both houses and apartments and is down 52% over August of last year. Builders Association President Sean Nelson says even though unemployment is dropping, many of the new jobs don't pay well enough and potential buyers can't qualify for mortgages. Nelson also says construction costs are rising, partly because of a requirement to install fire sprinklers in large new houses.
It's a new mandate on new single-family residential homes that will increase the cost by, you know, $10,000 or more for a new home.
The Department of Labor and Industry approved the sprinkler mandate last month. It goes into effect in January and requires fire sprinklers in new homes in Minnesota that are 4,500 square feet and larger. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Old wooden barns are disappearing from Minnesota's landscape. They can be expensive to maintain and not suited to the needs of modern farming. Some topple over in storms or get pulled down. Others go up with a match. But one barn enthusiast found a different solution, one that taps a unique supply of labor. Sasha Aslanian explains.
When Scott Temple and his wife bought their 13-acre farm in Scott County a year and a half ago, it came with a storybook dairy barn, faded red boards, a steep metal roof, and an old brick silo. It was also falling apart.
The homeowner, when we did the first walkthrough, it was like, well, the barn's free. And, you know, we didn't really want to go in there. And, you know, we've got kids and visitors, and when you're worried about people falling through the floor, it's not a good situation.
Temple contacted a nonprofit called Friends of Minnesota Barns, a resource for people who want to preserve, repurpose, or relocate historic barns. Fixing Temple's old barn would easily have cost upwards of $32,000, he says, and the family keeps horses, so a tall dairy barn with a milking parlor wasn't really what they needed. So he found another solution. He's recycling it.
We can save these timbers. You know, you're not doing the air pollution, you're saving the landfill, and you're also creating a new product that can be reused.
A nonprofit called Better Futures Minnesota was happy to reclaim Temple's barn. Consultant Tim Roman says they want to give the weathered boards new life by turning them into furniture or flooring or other construction materials.
We want to target something like a 90% recovery rate, but when you're talking about 100-year-old barn wood that's seen 100 Minnesota winters, it's a challenge to get every last stick.
The four-man crew trying to salvage every last stick of this wood is new to the work. Better Futures Minnesota helps men who've been incarcerated learn new job skills and rebuild their lives. Jimmy Wren is the senior crew chief teaching the men.
Every day I see a big progress in them, you know. So it's huge when it comes to getting released from prison or whatever. It's hard to find a job. So we teaching them skills that they could take somewhere else one day, hopefully.
35-year-old Ronald Crisp has been with the program since October.
What it takes is determination and 100% tired of negativity. And when you tire with that and you dissatisfied with yourself, you'll change. And that's what happened with me.
Crisp says he grew tired of his life on the streets and wanted to set a better example for his children. That's also the motivation for his crewmate, 25-year-old Doy Johns of North Minneapolis.
I was gone for 34 months, 3 years, for possession of a firearm. Just wanted to do something different. I got six kids that's all young, under the age of six. So I just wanted to do something different and show them a different positive role model because I've been missing for 3 years out of their life.
The men are paid $12 an hour and have health care, housing, and a life coach. Better Futures Minnesota works with trade unions to help the men graduate to better-paying jobs. On this hot August afternoon, what was the Cadillac of dairy barns in its day has been stripped down to the studs. The crew strategizes how to pull it over on its side to pick the carcass clean, and owner Scott Temple reflects on the community that built it. This nearly century-old barn is now giving rise to a different kind of community building.
In its dying gasp, this barn can really, you know, provide a future for a lot of people in various ways.
Next month, Friends of Minnesota Barns is hosting a tour to showcase some of the best preservation and reuse ideas for Minnesota's historic barns. And for those that can't be saved, Temple hopes at least the timber can. Sasha Eslanian, Minnesota Public Radio News, Elko.
A group of Twin Cities business and political leaders is trying to drum up support and cash to bring a World's Fair to Minnesota in 2023. Backers of the bid say such an event would put Minnesota on the world stage and bring millions in tourist money to the region. We go back to Matt Sepik for more.
Alfred Heller is about as big of a World's Fair buff as you'll find anywhere. He's written a book about them, once edited a quarterly historical magazine called World's Fair, and has been visiting the international expos since 1939, a year the United States hosted two in New York and San Francisco. Heller, now 85 and retired, went to Expo 2010 in Shanghai, China, the biggest fair ever, and says it was a trip he'll never forget.
You can't get that on television. You have to feel it. You have to see it. You have to experience what they're trying to tell you.
189 countries set up exhibits in Shanghai. The central government spent $45 billion to remake the city, more than it spent on the Olympics in Beijing 2 years earlier. Even though Minnesota's plans are far less ambitious, Heller says promoters here shouldn't expect much help from the federal government. The last time the United States hosted a World's Fair was in 1984 in New Orleans. The event failed to draw the predicted crowds, and Heller says it ended in bankruptcy.
Congress didn't want to spend any more money when these things kept coming up.
In fact, he says Congress won't even pony up the $25,000 in annual dues to the Bureau of International Exhibitions, the Paris-based group that sanctions World's Fairs. That makes it harder to get approval for events in the United States. But it's not stopping World's Fair promoters in the Twin Cities. Former Carlson Company's CEO Marilyn Carlson Nelson is an honorary co-chair of the Expo 2023 Advisory Committee, as is former Vice President Walter Mondale. Outgoing Minnesota Secretary of State Mark Ritchie is leading the effort. Ritchie says the event will be an opportunity for Minnesota to show itself off to an international audience.
It's a way for Minnesota to both welcome the world to come visit and find out who we are, and for us to learn from and be part of and see others from all over the planet.
Ritchie says he doesn't yet have a cost estimate for the event, but does say some sort of public-private partnership will be necessary. Ritchie is already touting the potential economic benefit, especially the money spent by what he estimates will be 10 to 15 million visitors, including 2 to 4 million from outside the United States.
For every million visitors from overseas, they spend around $1 billion. So you'll have $4 to $8 billion in tourist spending by people who come from overseas.
Haywood Sanders, a professor at the College of Public Policy at the University of Texas at San Antonio, says beware of these promises of big money. For decades, Sanders has studied what he says are the usually overblown economic predictions associated with conventions and other big events.
An Olympics or a World's Fair is a kind of sugar high for a community. You get a short-term burst of international attention and media recognition, but that doesn't necessarily last very long.
World's fairs in years not ending in 0 or 5 are normally a fraction of the size of the big Shanghai-style expos, and Sanders says if the 1982 and 84 fairs are any indication, most visitors to a 2023 expo in the Twin Cities will probably come from Minnesota and its neighboring states.
What we certainly found in the two last U.S. ones, in Knoxville and in New Orleans, is that lots of the folks who come are folks who are locals, folks who day trip.
Sanders says, though, that those visitors will spend money, and a World's Fair could bring a hyper-localized economic benefit to the area immediately surrounding the event site. This early in the process, promoters still haven't decided exactly where that'll be. Mark Ritchie of the Expo 2023 Organizing Committee says they're still considering ideas for a theme and also raising money to put together a formal bid, which is expected to cost $1 to $2 million and is due by the end of next year. Ritchie says the Bureau of International Exhibitions could decide on a 2023 World's Fair site by late in 2016. So far, there are no other cities competing. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Speaking of fairs, during the run of the Minnesota State Fair, we've been introducing you to some of the animals there. If you go into the DNR building, you'll find an exhibit featuring 10 different kinds of snakes that live in Minnesota. Morning Edition producer Jim Bickle stopped by the exhibit and chatted with Beth Gerard, a volunteer with the Minnesota Herpetological Society. She showed him the biggest snake that's found in our state. It's known as the bull or gopher snake, and it can grow to be 6 feet long.
The brown and yellow markings help to identify this species, especially along the, once it reaches the tail, you notice it changes to bands, the blotching. It's a constrictor, so you can tell she's wrapping herself around, getting a good hold, not trying to hurt me, just not wanting to be dropped onto the ground. She's doing to me what she would do to a limb of a tree.
Will they constrict to kill the prey?
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, with a mouse, she would strike quickly, grab it with her mouth, and then very, very quickly wrap her entire body around it. And then as the animal exhales, she tightens. And so very quickly, the animal suffocates.
The gopher snake, was it named for Minnesota gophers? Or?
Nah. Well, actually, it's the long history of having gophers in our state, which brought about Goldie Gopher, and the gopher snake does love to eat gophers.
Is the habitat for snakes diminishing?
Oh, definitely. And one of their biggest problems is the same as it is with turtles, and that's road crossings. And it's not just crossing the road, but there are some areas where they will move out onto the road even to warm up, not recognizing it as a potential danger.
Now, I heard we had an escape the other day.
Oh, yes. Well, with our new enclosures, they were built by a wonderful company that does amazing work, but they do mostly aquatics. And so the vents are all 1/4 inch by 2 inches. And as long as a snake can flatten out its head, if it can get its skull through, it can get its body through. And some, like racers, garter snakes, milk snakes, are amazing at the way they can compact and compress their bodies to get where they want to be, which is away.
So how far did the snake get?
Only a few feet before somebody grabbed her, and she's off exhibit now.
Which snake was that?
It was the North American racer, the female. But you can still come see the male.
That's Beth Gerard with the Minnesota Herpetological Society talking with Morning Edition producer Jim Bickle about the snake exhibit in the DNR building at the State Fair. And we're checking in with first-timers at the State Fair this week. It's one thing to be new to Minnesota, but another to be new to the continent as well. Producer Brita Green has this report from a native of the Middle East.
So where are you coming from?
I'm actually from Iran, and we moved here 5 years ago, but I never got the chance to just visit State Fair, and this is my first time here.
What were you expecting?
I think I expected something similar, but this is actually more fun. We've been, you know, drinking some beer, and I've never saw a pig before. I'm a city girl, so this was the first. Yeah.
So what did you think of the pig?
They're really large. So the the ones that I saw actually, it was only on movies, so they were always smaller. So it was the first time, and I was shocked that they can be like beef or the like cows, they can be huge. I'm looking forward to the foods on stick. I've never tried those.
Rita Green there talking about first-timers at the State Fair. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. That's a wrap on the week's news. With a holiday on Monday, I'll be back with Minnesota News on Tuesday.